Welcome everyone to Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia, and today we have a very special guest. His name is Blair Enns. Blair Enns is a Canadian author. He's written two books that I know of. One is called Win Without Pitching Manifesto, and the other one is called Pricing Creativity. And we're going to talk about both of his books, and we'll also discuss a little bit of his body of work when it comes to a specific podcast that he has that I follow, one of my favorite podcasts, which is called Two Bobs. So we'll discuss that. And then maybe towards the end, we'll kind of pick his brain around his own advisory practice, you know, how he manages his advisory practice. And his focus or his area of work is working with what he calls creative firms. And I would say, without excluding anyone in particular, marketing firms, advertising firms, public relation firms, maybe graphic design firms. And his role really is to help them with sales training, help them with pricing training. And that's, we're going to talk a lot about pricing. But then around pricing, there's just a lot of disciplines that come with it that Blair's an absolute genius at. So we'll discuss with that. Blair, are you on? Are you in?
I'm here, Hector. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Welcome to the show. Did I miss something in the introduction? Did I characterize you well?
No, that's fantastic. Thank you.
Okay, so let's jump right in. So Blair, your first book called Win Without Pitching, which I would argue to be that's what catapulted you and gave you exposure to the world about your area of expertise. What exactly is it about? And remember, most of our audience are software consultants and accountants. So what is the problem you're trying to solve for the marketing agency type of business?
Yeah, so we'll talk about that first, and then we can blow it up to how it's relevant to other businesses. But in the creative profession, so as you articulated, it's essentially designers, advertising, public relations, and others kind of related to those professions. There is a problem in the world of how they sell their services. That problem is known as the pitch or the free pitch. And in the pitch, a creative firm is invited by, it's a client-driven selection process, and the clients invite various firms to compete for the business. And in that competition, they are told, or it's implied that it's in their best interest to cross the line that separates proving their ability to solve the client's problem from actually solving the problem. So essentially, the way the convention is in the creative professions is if you want to win new business, you have to give away your highest value product, your thinking, your ideas, your strategic counsel, and your creative ideas for free as a means of earning the higher volume, lower margin, and lower value work that follows after that. So that's just a long-standing convention. It started in the advertising business, so it's kind of known in some circles as the advertising disease, and it's spread to other areas. And what we at Win Without Pitching do is we deprogram creative professionals of their need and their own internal biases to want to kind of compete in that arena. And we teach them that there's a different way to go about getting new clients that's far less expensive, and it doesn't kind of concede the high ground of the expert practitioner to the client.
And this, I would say that the major issue with this is that whether you're a big marketing firm or a big accounting firm, a solo marketer, advertiser, solo accountant, whatever, I think it all translates is we got to impress the client, right? We have to walk in and we have to convince the client in that pitch, right? That we are the best fit or the best expert. And in order to do so, we have to give away the store. Now, I think the both of us, Blair, you and I, believe that giving away your knowledge is actually an incredibly effective marketing tactic, as we do it with my YouTube videos, and you do it with your podcast and everything you do. But you don't have to give it all away up front to win the business. There are other ways to win the business, and that's kind of the theme of your book, right?
It is, and I'm glad you point that out, because in the age of content marketing, which used to be known as education marketing, you know, here we are, you're doing a podcast, you've got a series of videos that are quite popular, and you're essentially giving your ideas, your advice away for free. And that's a perfectly legitimate way to actually demonstrate your expertise and to attract prospective clients to you. The line is when you begin to apply your advice to a client's specific situation. So you give it away in generalities. You talk about in this situation, you do this. But when somebody comes to you, and you probably get these inquiries all the time, I know I do, they think because you're putting free general advice out there that if they email you with this situation about their, you know, looking for advice about their situation, that and some people are really good at actually responding to those. I don't, but to me, there's a very definite line that separates. As soon as somebody asks me to apply my advice to their specific situation, they need to pay me a lot of money. If people want to tune into the podcast or watch videos or read the articles or read my books for free or for very little money and then apply that advice to success, fantastic. That's great. That's what it's there for. The understanding is some of those people are going to want more, and those people are willing to pay a lot to actually have you apply your advice to their specific situation.
And that's what we call, or that's what I call advisory work, right? It's taking general concepts. Like, you know, most of my advisory work, it's stuff that you can find that's general knowledge. Like anyone that tells me, you know, Hector, I can't afford you, I can say, well, go read Peter Drucker. Go read Implementing Value Pricing. Go read, you know, the 7 Habits of an Effective Person. Go read The Speed of Trust. Go read, you know, there's some 0 to 1 best book, one of the best business books ever. You know, yep. Go read these 7 pieces of books, and you don't need a consultant. You don't need to hire an advisor. All the information is there. But I think the average person either doesn't believe that they can extract it from it, doesn't have the time to try to connect the dots and assimilate that to their business, or wants to work with someone that's already done it. They already made the mistake. They already saw it happen. They already crafted a solution similar to mine into another business, and they want the easy way. And that really is the easy way, just asking the question to the expert and getting that answer. But that cannot be given away for free.
Yeah. And, you know, as you kind of alluded to, there are different levels of success in business. And there's, you know, when you're starting out, you probably have more time than you do money. So when you're starting out, you read all the books, you watch the videos, you listen to the podcasts. And not that you don't do that as you progress in business and become more successful, but as you become more successful, the impact of bringing in a consultant, an advisor of some kind, is actually significant, or potentially even it's potentially greater when you're running a larger business, and you have the money to do it. So you're more inclined to skip all of the reading and trying to apply the advice on your own and just bring in the experts. So a more experienced client is willing to spend money in order to save time.
That's perfect. And so let's talk about Win Without Pitching real quick. So you have the book. It's not a fable. It's not a novel. It's not trying to convince the reader otherwise. You laid out like 12 commandments, and you say, look, this is a business model, right? That's around value. It's around valuing yourself. It's around, you know, being different. And you set this sort of like 12 rules up. And I'll just read the 12 rules, if you don't mind, and then maybe we'll deep dive in one of them. Okay. So we have, we will specialize. We will replace presentations with conversations. We will diagnose before prescribing. We will rethink what it means to sell. We will do with words what we used to do with paper. We will be selective. We will build expertise rapidly. We will not solve problems before we're paid. And we just talked about that, right? We will address issues of money early. We will refuse to work at a loss, which accountants appreciate very much. We will charge more, and we will hold ourselves to high standards, or our heads high. So those are your 12 rules, and that's your 130, 140 page book, kind of just deep dives into each one, helping the user be convinced that there's a better business model out there than the one that you described earlier. So I want to deep dive into one in particular that has impacted me a lot, which is we will address issues of money early. And before you jump in and explain that, as an accountant, I'm supposed to speak about money with ease, right? I'm supposed to have seen millions of numbers, big numbers and small numbers. And naturally, it is expected of me to be able to talk about money early on, easily, without fear, right? What exactly do you mean by we will address the issues of money early?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I say this in the book, but we think about a lot of us find money conversations stressful. I know my own accountant finds it very difficult to talk directly about money. When I'm signing off on the year-end stuff at the end of the year, he slides an engagement letter in for next year, and my wife and business partner accidentally signed it. It was like, whoa, wait a minute, hold on. We need to have a conversation about what we're buying here. They just do it every year. They just try to slide it past us. That's no conversation. So there's a lot of people find money conversations stressful, but stress is caused by the things that you don't do. So the reason money conversations are stressful is because we're avoiding them. So we want to kind of condition ourselves to lean into money conversations. And you can do that. It takes a little bit of training. It certainly didn't come natural to me. And there are times even today where I kind of defer money conversations and I know I shouldn't. So I don't feel like I've mastered that, but I do feel like I generally live by that principle. So if you're going down kind of a long road that is the sales cycle, and you get to the end of the road, no matter what business you're in, you get to the end of the road and you find out the client can't afford you, and you find yourself frustrated because you've invested so much time in this relationship or traveling down this road, you have nobody to blame but yourself. You should have spoken about money early. In many firms, it makes sense to have a minimum level of engagement as essentially a hurdle that you would place in front of the client and ask them to jump over. And there are other ways to talk about money as well. But you should be, if there are any concerns about money, if there are any issues around the client's ability to afford you and understanding of what the investment level might be, you want to get that out of the way first. Or if not out of the way, you want the hurdle that money might represent to be cleared. So that if the deal falls apart in the end, the client doesn't hire you, you walk away, whatever it is, it's not going to be because there was a misunderstanding around how much it would cost, or the client claims just outright, we just don't have the ability to pay that much money.
And we'll transition to value afterwards. So I'd like to talk about money just for now, if you don't mind. I like to deep dive as an accountant. I love this topic. So when you're talking about addressing issues with money, we're talking about that B word, right? That budget, right? And that B word could be what the client has in a piece of paper somewhere authorized, right? This is what you have authorized to spend. In some cases, the person that you're talking to doesn't have a pre-authorization of what that budget is, or doesn't know what that budget should be. Certainly in the accounting world, companies don't really earmark a certain amount of money for accounting, whereas in marketing or advertising, companies have a general rule of thumb, like we'll reinvest 10% of our sales back into marketing or something like that. I'm sure you can speak much more intelligently about that because that's not my area of expertise. But when it comes to accounting, we talked to a client that called us over to say, hey, I need an accountant, or I need a new accountant, or I need a solution to an accounting and finance problem, and I'm hoping you can help me. At first, we dedicate a lot of time to understanding whether or not we can solve that issue, and which makes total sense because you need to make sure there's a fit. But we wait until the end to discuss money or budget. What are your thoughts about customers that have this predetermined budget in mind, and how do you extract from them? Because there are some that just don't want to give it away, at least they feel like that's a card that they're going to wait later on to hold on to and use. So what are the ways we can extract that conversation out in the open early?
Yeah. So the first question around budget is typically, there's some nuance around where this might be different, but generally speaking, the first question around budget shouldn't be what is your budget, but it's have funds been allocated? Have you allocated a budget for this? Yes or no? If that's helpful information to know just in and of itself, because if the answer is yes, then the client is almost certainly late in the stages of deciding to hire a firm like yours. If the answer is no, it still could be late stage. They could be at the stage in the buying cycle where they've formed intent. Now they just need to allocate resources. So it's a nice entree into the budget conversation is to ask not how much do you have, but have you allocated a budget for this? If the answer is yes, then you say, great, how much? In some situations, particularly with professional buyers, you might hear, well, I'd rather not disclose that. Now, that is a ridiculous response, and I don't think you should give a prospective client a free pass on that. It's actually in everybody's best interest where if a client has set a budget, that they share that budget with you, because you can hit the client's, generally speaking, anybody can hit the client's budget number. It's just a matter of what's included in the services to meet that budget. And what's, you know, if it's a really low number, you could just think about stripping out all these other adjacent forms of value that are kind of that people buy in addition to the core service of accounting. We could talk about that more later. So if the client in a situation where you ask and the client says, no, we haven't set a budget at all, we're hoping you could sell us. That's kind of you could tell us or you could help us set a budget. That's a better situation to be in because of it's probably a principle you've talked about before, this concept of price anchoring, that essentially the first piece of information on a subject tends to skew the final outcome. So in a budget negotiation, excuse me, you want to be in a position where you can be the one to put the first number on the table and you want that number to be high and then the conversation will ensue from there.
You know, as you were mentioning that, I was thinking, you know, I've been referred to other professionals before, and I remember the person referring it to use. He's expensive, but he's good as a way to sort of emphasize that. Say, hey, I'm gonna recommend you my attorney. He's expensive, but he's good. That little statement there, it frames everything around that conversation. Like you walk into that meeting with that person, with that little thing sitting there, either in your conscious or in your subconscious. And it makes it difficult to stay away from that. Is that, I know it's not the type of anchor that you talk about in your book, but is that a form of an anchor when people have this preconceived notion that they're expensive but good?
It's a form of signaling, and signaling is just economists speak for essentially communicating other information. So pricing is, in many ways, it's positioning, it's reflective of, you know, when we hear somebody's expensive, we immediately kind of assume, well, they must be good. I remember my IP lawyer, when I first needed him, I cast it about, and it was a fairly serious issue, so I cast about for a good IP lawyer. And when I was told, well, he charges $900 an hour, I thought, perfect, this is the one I want. I like to say, lawyers are like steaks. If you're going to get one, spend the money and get a good one. So I cringe at his bills, but on something as vital as protecting my intellectual property, I would rather pay a really expensive lawyer and know that as he's walking me through a situation, I just have absolute confidence in him. And I get so much confidence from A, the name of the firm that he's with, and B, the amount he charges. And you know, I could easily find a lawyer that's a lot cheaper, but the amount of empowerment or confidence I would get from the engagement would be less. There's so much signaling power wrapped up in a price. And I'll give you another example. Excuse me. When I was selling graphic design services many years ago now, I used to have this line, and I was new to a certain geographic market. I'd moved to that market, and I was running a satellite office of a firm there. I used to say, and it was a very high quality design firm, I used to say to prospective clients, we're the most expensive firm in the market. And I would occasionally say to somebody, if they smiled at that or something, I would say, and if you find anybody who's more expensive than us, I'd appreciate it if you let me know. And the implication is that we would raise our prices. So that's just an example of having fun with the signaling power of prices.
And I was listening to a person that's a fan of yours. His name is Chris Doe. And, yeah. And I don't know if he took this from you or, but I mean, almost everything he says, it comes from you, I think. And he gives you credit for sure.
Yeah.
And I'm not in the graphic design business at all, but I'm just fascinated by how other industries approach the same problems that we have, which is we go from technician to expert to sort of practitioner, project manager, to then advisor, right? And we kind of almost everyone goes through that journey. Like when a lot of doctors retire, they end up being that second and third opinion for some of the bigger hospitals that retain them just to like look at a case and say yes or no, kind of like Dr. House type of thing. So I think that all professionals go through that journey. And I just like seeing them in different industries. I just got exposed to this creative industry recently because I received a lead from a sort of mid-sized graphic design firm that saw me in YouTube and said, hey, you know, you work with creators. You know, I think you will be a good fit for us because my old accountant wasn't creative at all. And it's hard to find a creative accountant type of thing. So I've been starting to get exposed and I'm just fascinated by that. Even though the problems are different from words and technicalities, they're actually essentially the same problem. But he said something that I thought was pretty neat, which said, when you're working this notion of price in the conversation, you almost have to insinuate like casually that it's obvious that both parties know that you're the most expensive option. Almost like, you know, obviously we're the most expensive choice, but we'd like to understand why you like to work with us and what, who else have you looked at? So it's almost a mind trick, right, Blair, that you're saying, you know, it's obvious we're the most expensive. And that's how you start the conversation. And I think most people would be afraid of starting off that way because, you know, of the negative connotation of being the most expensive or being so cocky that you're starting off with that. But you're saying that, no, you're saying that's a good approach.
Well, I think if you're going to lead with that, you want to be confident that you are the most the most expensive, because it would look pretty bad if you say, obviously we're the most expensive, and the client comes back and says, well, actually we're talking to somebody who's three times the price as you you are. <That's> shows true. That you're out of touch with your market. I like the and Chris is a very confident person. I love the, and if anybody's watching his videos, the future without an E on the end is incredible. What he's doing for the bringing business acumen to designers and design students is actually awesome. And he does cite a lot of our stuff, and he's very good at it. He's very good for us too. We have a great relationship with him. But the you know, back to that signaling power of pricing. If you are the most expensive, you want to own it. Either the language that I use or the language that Chris used in this example, you do want to make sure that when you're saying, obviously, we're the most expensive option, you want to have some degree of certainty that you are the most expensive option. And if you're not the most expensive option, you know, there are, if you're a young business and you're just starting out, there's, it's known as penetration pricing, is essentially lowering your price to penetrate into a market. That's a valid mechanism for building a business. So I'm out there offering guidance saying you should price more, you should charge more, you should elevate, etc. You absolutely want to get there over time. And in, you know, for listeners of this podcast, Hector, you know, if they're trying to elevate themselves to that advisory status, they absolutely need to embrace the fact that they charge a lot relative to other practitioner types. They need to own it. They want to be upfront to their clients about that.
Now, nobody's ever born being the most expensive. That's another really important point. Like we're not unilaterally saying that all advisors need to walk in saying, obviously we're the most expensive. You know, one of the things that you talk about in Win Without Pitching, it's, and I'm gonna sort of conflate two of your concepts together. One is we will specialize. And the other one is we will build expertise rapidly. Because to me, those two things are the same. Obviously, the way you explain them in the book, they're not. But that does come with the territory. And if anyone, an accounting professional that wants to focus on, let's say, real estate and, you know, investors of distressed properties, and that's going to be your focus niche target market, you may need to penetrate with aggressive pricing just to get in it and to learn. And it's possible that some of these customers will buy on price, and they will buy because they're for the less expensive choice, and give you the opportunity to learn and understand this business. That business owner will also more likely understand or imply that because they're paying the lesser amount, it's not going to be as precise, or the solution may take multiple iterations, right, to get to the right one. And working with that professional could be easy to work with, but it's just not going to be as fast, as effective as working with, let's say, the most expensive or the best option. So neither Blair or I are saying that anyone's born being the most expensive, being the best, or being the most specialist and biggest expert, or at least have the position to do so. There's a transition element to it. But once you get to the point where you are an expert, and I think this is where most people in my position get to, where they are an expert, but they just don't create any marketing around the fact that they are experts, and they don't price or position themselves around that. So they are the experts, but no one knows it until you actually do the job that you severely underpriced. So can you talk about specializing and becoming an expert from your perspective?
Yeah. And as you pointed out, of those two principles in the book, The Win Without Pitching Manifesto, we will specialize and then we will build expertise rapidly. The second one is an outcome of the first. So when you specialize, when you narrow your focus, the reason we specialize is the only meaningful differentiator between you and other advisors that the client might consider hiring is really the depth of your expertise. And you specialize in order to build deeper expertise faster. So this is one of the things that's interesting about the creative professions that might not translate directly to accounting, but those who are listening will either identify with this statement or not. And the idea is creativity is the ability to see. So it's the ability to bring a novel solution or perspective to a problem. Therefore, creative people are drawn to problems that they have not previously solved. Therefore, when creative people, and I don't mean just designers, but people who have this ability to kind of see around corners and bring perspective, when they build businesses, their tendency is to create a business that allows them to solve all kinds of different problems. And then I come along and say, no, you need to specialize. So by kind of having your vision span the horizon, looking for problems and solving all of these different types of problems, you don't build a depth of expertise. It's not until you narrow your focus and start solving the same types of problems over and over again that you build expertise rapidly. And a great physical metaphor for this is if I took a contents of a beer bottle or this club soda can, and let's say the contents of this can represents the entire kind of some abilities of your firm, the entire capacity, intelligence capabilities of your firm. And then I chose to empty this into, I need to empty it into a vessel to be able to kind of harness it. So I can empty it into a casserole dish, and you'll see in the casserole dish that your expertise is spread really thin across a wide area. But if I empty it into a Pilsner glass, you'll see that your expertise does not spread very wide, but the same amount of kind of capabilities, the depth of your expertise is exponentially deeper than a generalist. So you do build expertise rapidly simply by narrowing your focus. And to some people that comes natural, but generally speaking, the more creative you are, the more inclined you are to build a generalist practice. And then you start, rationalizing why generalist practice might be better than a specialist practice. In the early days, it's perfectly fine to have a generalist practice because your career kind of should look like this. You should start out trying all these different things, and then you find what really works for you and you specialize. So early on, you start as a generalist. Maybe you go work for a bunch of different generalists or a bunch of different specialists. You kind of build your own expertise. And as you launch your advisory business, you want to specialize so that you, it makes it easier for you to build deeper expertise.
And I like the way you said that. And I actually haven't heard it before. And I've heard every one of your podcasts there, by the way. But when you are creative, or you tend to feel that you want, that you are creative, or you want to be a creative person, because there's three different things. So, because there are people that are not creative, but the perspective of then having a creative life, you know, where unpredictable things happen to them and unpredictable solutions are applied. Those tend to fear specialization, just because of specialization will lead to boredom, but potentially. Because we're creative people and we want different problems, we want different issues, we want different industries. But the second issue is, and that's more the internal problem, the external problem is people feel that specializing gives you this whole pigeon, like puts you in a box or pigeonholes you, where you're sort of typecasted to only know how to do one thing. And I think a lot of professionals, whether you're a creative professional or a non-creative accountant, we don't want to be known just for one thing. I don't know if it's something psychological where, hey, look, I'm more than just this dimension persona that you're putting with me. But how do you address both of them? Like, if you're consulting me and I'm telling you this, hey, look, I don't want to be bored. I don't want to be pigeonholed. I want to have an open field. Like, convince me that I have to specialize, you know, in a deep way, a soulful way. Like, why do I need to specialize?
Well, the first thing I would say is the pigeonholes are stuffed with cash. People say, I don't want to be pigeonholed. That's where the cash is, in the pigeonholes. The second thing is, you, especially the more creative you are, the more you're going to have to address the concern you have that you will die a death of boredom by doing the same thing over and over again. And I like to say, and I talk about this in the manifesto, another metaphor is you have this highly creative entrepreneur who's built this business that allows them to go anywhere and do almost anything. So the metaphor is, you are standing in a room full of doors and you're a highly curious problem solver. You want to know what is behind every door. And as a creative entrepreneur, you have built your business that allows you to open any door. As long as there's money and a potential engagement behind it, you could go through any door. And I'm standing behind you, over your shoulder, I'm saying to you, no, Hector, for the sake of your business and ultimately your life, you need to pick a door, you need to walk through it, and you need to never look back. And you think that when you open up that one door and you walk through it, you're going to die this death of boredom. It's just going to be one big, empty, gray, boring room. But that is not what is on the other side of that door. What's on the other side of that door is more doors than you can ever imagine. Not more door, but more doors than you can ever imagine in your wildest dream. It's like you crawl through this crack into this room that is your specialization. And it opens up like the wardrobe in Narnia. There's Narnia in there. You will see niches and crevices and nooks and crannies that you didn't even know existed until you walked through that door.
So Lord of the Rings and Narnia, all in the same all in the same answer. Now that's great, Blair. So thank you very much for that. So I'm sold. Anyway, great. Let's move on to, I'd like to talk about this book. For a couple of reasons, this book is called, for the people listening on the podcast, I'm holding Pricing Creativity, A Guide to Profit Beyond the Billable Hour by Blair Enns. And this is not a book. This is actually like a trapper keeper. What do you call those things? It's like a clip binder.
It's a three-ring binder.
It's a three-ring binder that contains essentially a book, but it has multiple tabs. And the tabs are, okay, these are the principles of value pricing. And, you know, I can clearly tell that your target market for this is a creative profession. But if I didn't know that, I would not have noticed. So in other words, because I know who you are, Blair, and who you focus on, this is only for creative professionals. But if you if you don't think about that and you read this and you replace the word logo with tax return, it's synonymous or litigation or whatever profession you may be. So what the book does is explains very brief the principles of value pricing, which are heavily influenced by the Bible, right? Ron Baker's implementing value pricing. And I read Ron Baker's implementing value pricing, and I didn't think another book could ever compare to it. And I don't want to compare the books, but I would love to call this one a perfect continuation of it, where Ron Baker's implementing value pricing presents the framework, right? So whenever you're worried about, am I doing this right? You go back to the Bible and check the principles, right? And then what your book does is effectively be a desk reference. And you didn't want it to be a book. You want it to feel like an office tool, something that you can pull up and use the tabs to quickly go through and say, okay, I'm putting this proposal together. What am I missing here? And they go back to the principles and techniques and tools you have in there. So I like to talk about that book and obviously plug it. First, let me start by something unconventional, which before we talk about the book, I talk about the pricing of the book. And the reason why I think I like to talk about the pricing of the book is because you priced this book. And I think calling it a book is also kind of a mistake because it makes you think about a traditional book. But you priced this knowledge tool in the same way that you recommend that we price our professional services. You are giving us three versions of it, right? I think first version is a PDF or an ebook. The second version is the PDF or the ebook. It's not a PDF, it's an ebook, sorry. It's an ebook.
Yeah.
Second version is the ebook with the binder. And then the third version is the ebook, the binder, and a video that kind of summarizes it or adds some additional value or some additional notes to that. Five videos from the author, from the, with your voice, which is great. And you don't have a audiobook version of this, which would be nice. Just because there's so many visuals involved, it will be difficult to explain in an audiobook. And you price it at $100, $200, and I believe $350 for the last.
$100 for the ebook, $199 for the ebook and the manual, and $320 for the ebook, the manual, and the videos.
That's what it is. And Blair's not selling it to you. What we're doing is explaining that the person that's citing to be an expert in pricing, it's applying this in real life. And also, I thought Ron Baker's book was expensive at like $60. This is obviously a change of mindset for me. The reason why I think it's particularly compelling is because this knowledge tool, which is not a book, it's a knowledge tool. When I received this in the mail, I paid $200 for it, right? And I think that in itself caused me to read it in a different way.
Yes.
And in addition to that, it also set the expectation subconsciously that, hey, you're not reading this. You're implementing this, right? Because you invested in this. This is not a book that I put on the shelf. It's a knowledge tool. So I like to say that. So let's talk about some of the details of the book. So one of the things that I really liked, and it was a different spin on how I'm used to thinking about pricing options, is you have this concept of pricing inputs, pricing outputs, and pricing value. And sometimes we can see that as offering three options or not. So I'd like for you to talk about that. Pricing inputs, pricing outputs, and pricing value.
Yeah. So inputs in accounting profession are typically time and maybe, I'm not sure what the materials are in the accounting profession.
It's really just data entry. Like we're transcribing information from one place to the other. That would be the materials.
Right. So you're charging for your time. And that's how my accountant charges me to do my accountant essentially charges me by the hour, I believe, to do my tax returns. And I need so much more from my accountant. And it's really uncomfortable for me because the engagement isn't structured in that, like if I pester him, he'll help me with some issues, but he has no mechanism for charging me for that. I would actually like to pay him more and be able to pick up the phone and call him and have him be available to me. So you're at the lowest level, you're charging your inputs of time. And when I, in the creative professions, and this almost certainly applies to accounting and other advisory businesses, there are three levels of financial success that I see. And the first level is the efficient firm. So in an efficient firm, you are capturing and billing as many of the available hours of the firm as possible. So you're tracking billable efficiency, you're logging time, et cetera. Now, the second thing that you can sell is the outputs. So it would be the tax returns. For tax returns, we charge X. If we're talking about tax, and there's all kinds of other outputs. Outputs. In the design business, it might be for the logo or for the campaign or for the website rather than by the hour. Generally speaking, when you charge for outputs, there is a degree, the client is paying a little bit more for something that's known as price certainty. So if I said to you, how much to do this for me to do my tax return, Oscar, and you said, well, it's X dollars per hour. And I ask, well, how many hours is it going to take you? And you say, well, it depends on the complexity. I see you're filing taxes in two different countries. You've got two different corporations, a personal, et cetera. So it really, I really can't tell you, Blair. It's going to be between X and Y. And so I'm taking a bunch of risk in there. You're passing, when you're selling inputs of time, you're passing all the risk onto me, the client. If I say how much for my tax return and you say for tax returns like this, we charge X, that X is usually on the high end of the earlier X to Y range. And it's allowing, it's you are now taking some of the risk, because if my tax return proves to be overly complex, then it takes you longer. That's the price doesn't change to me. So by buying the output of the tax return, you are taking some of the risk, but in exchange, anytime you, the seller, take more risk, the price generally goes up. So there's a price premium that I'm paying for price certainty. And then I might decide, well, I want that certainty. So the second level of success is not necessarily correlative to selling outputs, but it's really what I would call people who use progressive pricing practices. And we'll talk about some of those progressive pricing practices. And they essentially dip their toe into value-based pricing. But the third thing you can sell is value or outcomes. And I was working with a firm in Ireland recently where I was doing a public workshop, and one of the business owners whom I know, he's a client in our training program, he took me aside and he said, I got to tell you this story about my accountant. I was, he said, I brought my fairly complicated tax situation to him, and he came up with a solution that saved me €500,000, €500,000. And he said, you know, he charged by the hour for that. And I said, oh, imagine if he very quickly looked at my client's situation and knew that he was kind of overpaying over kind of a fairly lengthy period of time. He was overpaying to the tune of around €500,000. And he could have said, you know, I think I can save you €500,000. If I did, would that be worth 50,000 or 25 or some number that would just put, you know, the idea of billable efficiency just to the sword? It would just seem ridiculous. But he didn't. He charged them for a few hours of his time, and it didn't take the guy very much time. So the highest level of financial success are those firms that move away from selling inputs, that move away from selling outputs and some of the progressive pricing tactics that we'll talk about, and they basically sell based on outcomes. If I could deliver €500,000 in value to you, would you pay me 50,000 or 25,000? So they're getting paid based on the value they create rather than the outputs that they're selling or the amount of inputs that they're incurring to deliver on the solution.
And I think you're referring a little bit to, I don't know if you read this book called Let's Get Real or Let's Not Play by Mahan Khalsa.
I own all the sales books because I own a sales training company. It's the only one I've ever read cover to cover.
This not only read cover to cover, but I often find myself opening it at any random page and reading seven pages just to, it's the book, Let's Get Real, Let's Not Play, talks about, and they're not talking to accountants, by the way, in this book at all. I think they're talking to consultants or salespeople, the author. But when I read this book, I felt he was talking to me. You know, this book is about, this could be an entire episode later with or without you, but we can discuss the book and there's a lot of depth to it. But it talks about getting from your client what is the ultimate value or what they will extract from the work that you will do. Measuring it, right? Because not everything is measurable. Like when somebody says, I want to improve my brand, you know, or brand awareness. Well, brand awareness is, but brand itself may not. Like I want a strong brand, but that's hard to measure. But I want to improve brand awareness. Well, that can't. We can actually count followers and shares and that sort of thing. But what he's doing is saying, look, the sales process should be about understanding ultimately what the client is going to extract out of value from the work that you produce. And if you can effectively measure it or talk about it in tangible terms, it is relatively easy to say, I can produce this for you. I can create this value for you with 20% of that work. Not with those exact words, but exactly what you're saying. You know, hey, if I could save you $100,000 worth of taxes next year to help you structure your corporate entities and the way the money flow works, you know, would $15,000 for that type of service sound ridiculous? Now, in the accounting world, there's all sorts of ethics and stuff that comes around saving people money and charging for a percentage of the money you save in taxes. That's borderline unethical. So that's a whole nother conversation. But I'm saying in general, we accountants, we control the client's numbers. We know about the client numbers. If we can tangibly speak about what we do and what that's worth at the end, it's very easy to price. So if we can create $100,000 worth of value or save them $100,000 worth of expenses, and we're going to charge a high number, let's say $900 an hour, and it took us 3 or 4 hours, we're still severely undercharging it. Because it only took us 4 hours to do, but it may have taken us 25 years to learn. And not just 25 years to learn, a whole bunch of capital that you invested as a business owner to get there. So, sorry, we went off tangent on that. And we may not get to all the stuff, Blair, because I know we're reaching top of the hour, and you just tell me when it's time to go. It's totally okay. So you talk about one thing that I thought it was pretty interesting, where if you round the price, let's say you're going to price something at, let's say, $5,000, you can defend a flat, seemingly arbitrary number like $5,000 a lot better or a lot easier than what seems to be a formulated or calculated number like $4,975. Yes. So why is that, Blair?
Because anytime your price implies a formula, the client is invited to use that formula to try to make the price lower. So I often do this as kind of a little experiment in a seminar where I'll say, okay, here's you have to go in this thought experiment. You have to go present a proposal for $50,000. Let's keep it at $5,000. And you have the choice. You can present the price of $5,000, nice round number, or $49.75. And which would you prefer to present? And most people choose the $49.75. They think it's some sort of charm pricing, or it seems more palatable because it starts with a 4 and not a 5. But what it's actually easier, as you said, it's easier to defend the nice big round number because there's no formula implied. So the pushback on the price, you know, you might get pushback on value, but if somebody says, well, that's a big round number. It looks like you just came up with it. How did you arrive at that price? One way to reply is to say simply that, well, that's what we charge companies like yours for services like this. Right, so you're not charging based on value, you're charging based on outputs, and you're saying, well, maybe not, but we'll get to that in a second. You're saying, no, this is what we charge. And if somebody says, well, what about return on investment? In the accounting profession, often I suspect you can show return on investment. In graphic design, in logos, as an example, it's really hard to show return on investment. So I counsel to say, well, I don't know what the return on investment is. I know this is what we charge companies like yours, and our clients keep coming back. So I'm assuming there's a return on the investment. You can't, and we could role play it, and I've role played it many times. You can't find a way to get me to make the price be cheaper. But if I put forward $49.75, you're going to ask, well, how many hours? How many, and what's your hourly rate? And you can push back and say, well, that hourly rate's really high, or it's not going to take you that long. So,
or itemize it, like itemize all the deliverables so people can pick and choose, say, you know what? I really don't need this. I really don't need that. And although I think you can justify taking out components of value, right, to lower a price, which I think is, it doesn't break the rules anyway of value pricing. The problem is that your services may be held together by a combination of things. You know, like it, I think it is quite possible that without 24/7 access to the accountant, whatever that happens to be, the whole thing will fall apart, right? Because we need the client to be on top, or we need them to ask us proactive questions and that and that sort of thing. So let me ask you the last question, Blair. And so real quick, pricingcreativity.com is where you can find information about Blair's book, the one that we're talking about, and winwithoutpitching.com about the other book. I suspect that a whole bunch of my colleagues are going to look at Pricing Creativity. I strongly recommend that book. So I'd like to ask you to tease us up real quick. And I'm going to ask you for the most valuable piece of the book, to me anyway. So we're going to talk about, to me, the most valuable piece of the work, the book talks about after you have that value conversation and you have, and we talked about value conversation in this podcast many times, after you have the value conversation, we extract everything that we need to extract from our customer around what is it that they want, what are the goals. You say something, I think it's just extremely impactful, which is say a price before you show a price. And yes, then how you follow up with that proposal, which is not the typical 5-page proposal, just the 1-page proposal. Can you give us a Reader's Digest version of that?
Yeah. So the rule of say a price before you show a price, that really comes from the world of sales and not pricing. And it speaks to what we were talking about earlier, Hector, about the idea of kind of leaning into the price and having money conversations early. If you don't want to come back with a proposal that where the client just looks at it and goes, well, there's just no way we can do that. So if there is a price objection, you want to hear it, and you want to hear it before you go into proposal development mode. So the idea is, and you pointed out Mahan Khalsa, you kind of articulated the first two steps of a value conversation, and the universal advice on how, on the framework for how to conduct a value conversation is identify the objectives, identify the metrics, identify the value that you might create. And then I add this fourth step is before you go away to assemble your proposal, you offer some pricing guidance. So based on the conversation you've uncovered, how much value you might create, you essentially say you have to do a little bit of math. It's mostly art. It's more art than science. But you essentially say, okay, I'm going to come back with some options, some different ways that we might be able to help you. And they're going to be priced in the Y to X. So in the $50,000 to $10,000 range. And the reason you start with Y is you want to anchor high. The first number that comes out of your mouth needs to be a high number. And there's, we won't get into the, you know, how you go about deciding what those numbers are. The low number, X of 10,000, might be the client's stated budget. 50,000 is a function of how much value you think you can create. And then at the end of the value conversation, you walk away and you go away to create your proposal. And if you're following one of my other rules, which is price the client, not the job, you're not saying, well, here are three options that we always put in front of everybody, bronze, silver, gold. You're essentially assembling these three options for that one client based on what they feel is important and based on the types of value that you might be able to create for them. And you put it forward in a one-page proposal that just shows three columns. Now, before I knew anything about value-based pricing, for years, I would say to my clients, the proposal is the words that come out of your mouth. The document is the contract. The contract does not come out until you have an agreement in principle on the proposal. But at the time, I was suggesting you just put forward one option. You figure out what the best solution is for the client, you put it forward with the price. Now, one of the rules is, the rules in the book, and I didn't invent the rule, but I see it as a rule, which is always offer options. So your proposal is one page, three options, beginning with the high anchor.
And again, go to pricingcreativity.com, pick up the ebook, the three-ring binder, or the binder plus video. It would be the best $100 to $320 you will ever spend in your life, guaranteed. And I think, Blair, you stated that you value guarantee your book. So you can read it, you can use it, you can become rich with it, and you can return it. Right?
If for any reason you are unsatisfied with your purchase, you can send it back at any time for a full refund.
I love that. And by the way, I've given refunds in the last year with those guarantees, and I gladly do it because for the 98% of people that haven't refunded, I've been able to double or triple my prices. Blair, let's end it with the best business advice you have ever received.
Oh, never break more than one law at a time.
What does that mean?
It means if you've got a body in the trunk of the car, don't speed.
Or fix that taillight, right?
Yeah.
Blair, thank you very much. It was an honor.
Yeah, the honor's mine, Hector. Thank you for having me on the show.